This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Welcome to Dishy Mix. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. Hey, I am so happy to have you listening to this particular show because we're going to have a lot of fun. Sometimes you learn things about people, sometimes you learn things about process, and in this particular case, we're going to have a good time because you're going to get to meet Jim Mascalskas. And what's great about Jim is that not only is he a super fun guy, but he's very, very smart, super wizened about the interactive media space. And I absolutely guarantee you'll have some fun and get some key takeaways you can apply to your business. So on today's show, we're going to talk about everything from Star Wars collectibles. That sounds fun to me. I always wanted to be Princess Leia. To the death of the ad network. We're going to go down the Inca Trail with Jim. We're going to talk about executing media according to the protocols of optimization, algorithms, and managing databases, which might actually be interesting and fun. And we're going to talk about peeing, because that is something that apparently Jim thinks is very, very important. So Jim is the VP and Director of Online Media at Icon International, which is a New York-based company. It's part of Omnicom's corporate trade barter business. And we're going to get Jim on the show and find out what the heck that is. Welcome, Jim.
Hello. How are you?
I am good. How are you, dear?
After such an excellent introduction, I am fabulous, grabulous, zip, zoop, zabulous.
Fabulous, grabulous. Wow. I wish this wasn't virtual. I'd be giving you a little pinch right now.
Now I'm turning red.
Woo! Better not let Jocelyn listen to this, huh?
She's out to lunch.
Okay, good. Phew. We're safe. We can flirt all we want. So, barter, Icon. I thought you were just like a massive media buying dude. What the hell is this barter stuff? You're not spending money?
Well, I actually am spending money. The big misnomer about barter is that what I'm really doing is I'm trying to secure media inventory with dump trucks full of broken toasters. And that is not actually what the barter business is. There's a great deal of cash in the marketplace. It's just the methods I employ to try to acquire inventory that is of a certain value in the marketplace is different than an agency is allowed to do.
So tell me about that. Give us an example, like make it real for us.
I will give you a real-world example. Okay. And what I'll do is I'll use the, though there are some examples that are even more fun, I'll use the one that somebody used for me when I first started about 3 years ago doing this and couldn't seem to grab any kind of sense of what it was about. All right, one of our clients is Tyson Chicken. And Tyson Chicken has the contract with McDonald's. And they send chicken McNuggets to McDonald's. And those McNuggets have to be to very, very precise specifications. There's got to be a certain number of breadcrumbs on them. They've got to be a certain shape, a certain size, a certain weight, a certain density. So when that person who is at the other end at the franchisee's place and they're zipping off that paper bag and pouring it into the fryolator, those things cook up in 2 minutes on the spot. If for some reason, and this happens from time to time, there are too many breadcrumbs on that chicken McNugget, or there are too few, or it comes out in the shape of a triangle instead of a kidney, or whatever it is that makes these McNuggets no longer McNugget acceptable, McDonald's turns them back, and they said, forget it, we don't want it. So let's say it's a truckload of these McNuggets, and Tyson's got on the books $1 million worth of nugget sales that they're anticipating, and that thing has worked its way through their balance sheets corporately. Suddenly they're stuck. They can do one of two things. They can liquidate the now distressed asset, i.e., these misshapen McNuggets, and sell them to prisons or hospitals or summer camps or public schools or wherever it is that these kinds of things can go. And they're going to get something south of $1 million. Likely they're going to get $250,000, maybe $300,000 for it. They can do that, and they can write that down and put it on their balance sheet as a loss. Or a company like Icon can come to them and say, hey, guess what, you guys? I will give you $1 million, and all you have to do is spend $5 million through my company. And we're going to identify what those things are that you're going to buy through us, and it's going to be stuff you buy anyway. So you don't have to spend any extra money, nothing new. You don't have to add to your expenses or anything. You're just going to buy whatever it is you buy, and I'll give you $1 million. And that is what we do. Now, there's ways to make that work, and why it is that we don't lose money is a longer conversation. And if you'd like, I can get into that. But that's how it works.
So when they're buying things from your company, are they buying advertising services?
That is correct. 90% of the time, what they're buying is media. Now, they can buy travel, and they can buy printing, and they can buy carpeting. But in order to earn off $1 million trade with $5 million worth of spend, you know, $5 million is a lot of hotel rooms. It's a lot of printing.
Where do the nuggets go?
The nuggets then are liquidated through whichever distribution channel the client approves.
The nugget liquidator.
Yes, that's right. And typically, and the nugget liquidator does all kinds of things that I'm sure we don't want to discuss now.
I'm not going to touch another nugget, I can tell you that. Not that I do.
But one of those channels of distribution are those that I had mentioned already that the client themselves would use,
yeah.
Which is the hospitals, the schools, the summer camps, the prison systems, whatever.
Got it.
We do the same thing. We don't have any magic juju to get any more money for. We still take the loss on the asset. But because what we are is a principal risk capital finance company, in essence, we assume that principal risk, and we make that loss our loss. And in exchange, the client agrees to do us this favor, and that favor is spending the money.
Okay.
It's a multiple of the loss.
And what I see now about why this was appealing to you is that it's more complex than buying media.
Yeah, it turns out that it kind of seems to be, yeah.
Because you like to put your brain in the accelerometer and push it to its highest velocity. That is what makes you happy. And so this is like, yeah, I'm a media guy, but I'm like the crazy media guy that does principal risk, whatever, gadoodly thing with media.
Yes.
Now
right.
I understand. Okay.
That's right.
And so you've been in media a long time. You've worked at Underscore, Pericles, Left Field, Hawk Media. You've had CKS, US Web. I'm missing one. I'm doing this from memory.
That's
Media Smith.
I forget what it is too.
Media Smith.
There you go. Oh, yeah, of course.
We're going to talk about Davey. Wavy Davey Gravy. We're going to talk about him in a minute. But you told me that the worst fork in the road of your life happened around your Underscore time. What was it?
I was working at Underscore. I was a partner there with Tom Hespos and Eric Porez. And the fork in the road was to continue or to try something entirely new. And what that something entirely new was, and this may come as a surprise to some, I'm not sure, was to leave the ad business altogether and apply to Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a dual, they still do, they have a dual program where you get a master's in theology and your master's in journalism. And I wanted to do that. And so I opted to leave my partnership at Underscore and to pursue that. And I ended up pursuing it a little bit, but I ended up not actually following through and going to school and all the rest. I did apply to the Graduate School of Journalism. I did get in. And once they, you know, when they tell you how much it's going to cost, you start to kind of think, well, let's see here. If I'm earning zero and I'm spending like somebody who's not earning zero, and then I add this Ivy League graduate school bill to it, where will I net out? And where I was going to net out was going to be a little bit painful. But I did pursue it for a number of months and then finally decided to take the time that I had suddenly found myself with to go for long walks, try to work on a novel, play some video games, get to know the city of New York better, see my family. I spent a lot of time going out to California and ended up having a very, very, very good, positive, soul-searching year. But leaving Underscore, in retrospect, Underscore was one of the best career work experiences I've had.
Well, we had Tom Hespos on just recently, and he also said that you're the most favorite person that he ever worked with.
Get out of here.
Swear to God. How come you didn't listen to that episode? You thought you knew everything about Tom Hespos, huh?
Wow.
Yeah, he really enjoyed working with you. I think because you come at things from such a creative perspective. And, you know, it's good that you pursued the idea of the Columbia education, and then you realized it actually wasn't worth the trade-off, so you at least explored it and didn't spend your life wishing you had. One more thing I'll tell you is that we're launching a new show on Personal Life Media. It's called Philosopher's Notes. It's about big ideas in philosophy, and it's kind of a Cliff Notes program. It's a weekly podcast. Actually, we're going to do a couple a week, and Brian Johnson is the host of the show, and in like 3 to 5 minutes, maybe 8 minutes, depending on what it is, he's going to go through not only all the classic philosophers, but it's like cliff notes. Okay, you want to understand these philosophers and what their construct was? He'll tell you. He'll tell you the answer. You don't have to read the work. He also does all the spirituality people, the consciousness people, the self-empowerment people. So there's every week a couple of these new philosophers' notes that you can listen to on the go.
Well, that's very cool. I mean, I'm staring at my office, two books on Heidegger,
right,
and one book by Theodor Adorno,
yeah,
on culture.
It's hard to read them. And one of
it
the things is that if you listen to the cliff notes of, you know, philosopher's notes and you like how Brian sums it up, that could say, all right, that one's actually worth reading. In my time of life right now, I could use that information. And sometimes they are and sometimes they're not. And you're trying to build a body of knowledge. So it in a way, at least gives you the highlights so you can make a decision about where you want to put your time.
Yes, no, that's a great thing. That's what's nice about survey work.
So now you worked also with John Durham. And John's been on DigiMix too.
Yeah, that's correct. John and I were also partners.
At Pericles, a great Roman statesman named after a guy who loved democracy, Pericles.
He's considered the father of democracy.
The father of democracy. And John Durham, what's he the father of?
What is John Durham the father of? Well, that's a really good question. Aside from my enthusiasm for Amarones, which has become a difficult and expensive pursuit.
Yeah.
I guess I could either thank him or blame him.
Are these cigars?
Birthing that in me.
Are they cigars or is it a liqueur?
Amarones are wine from the Veneto region of Italy.
Italy.
Yes. Oh. Yep. Italian wine. And they're really good. And if they're ever really good, they're not ever very inexpensive.
Right.
So if you want the good stuff, you're going to have to pay for it. And even the kind of good stuff, you're going to have to pay for it.
But it's totally worth it. I'd rather drink one fabulous bottle of wine than 3 or 5 or 10 crappy bottles of wine.
That is correct. And for the cost of one good bottle of Amarone, you could probably get 10 bottles of crappy wine.
Exactly. So you worked with John on Pericles Consulting. That was a Republican media company helping the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign.
That's right.
A bunch of Senate campaigns, all kinds of things. Now that you've seen the Obama Democratic campaign, what do you have to say about where politics and media, interactive media, meet?
Well, one of the things I want to make clear up front is that we weren't necessarily specific to the Republicans. It just worked out that way.
Yeah.
My decision when the three of us talked about will we accept this business was to adopt the philosophy that was applied to Voltaire by his biographer, which was that I may disagree with every word you say, but I will defend unto my death your right to say it.
Yeah, beautiful.
And so I took that approach, and that's kind of all of our approach. And, you know, let's face it, I mean, in business, there's only one party, the Green Party, and they don't mean the environment.
I understand.
But be that as it may, here's what was interesting about Obama, and here is how it differed, I think, from Republicans. And I'll try to make this all very, very brief, and here is how I think politics, at least for the time being, from a marketing perspective, is being used, is using the web. And that is that when we did it, we actually tried to do actual messaging on behalf of the Bush-Cheney reelection campaign. There was only one effort that we ended up executing against. It was a rather sizable one, and it was early in the campaign, but it was to message. It was not to solicit donations. It was not to talk about the other guy. It was strictly to say, hey, here's why I'm great. And it was the No Child Left Behind. It was to feature that initiative. And that was something that hadn't been done before, really. The Bloomberg campaign in 2000 had done some of that stuff at a local level. I guess 2001 is when that was. McCain, same thing, when he was running for the primaries in 2000. They did a little bit of that, but nobody really did it anything to the extent that we were doing it then in 04. What happened this time around is the Republicans almost ceded the space entirely to the Democrats when it came to buying messaging. Now, a lot of the messaging itself was actually fundraising messaging, and what we found, because we did a lot of that for the Republican National Senatorial Campaign Committee in 2004, all of their messaging was sort of a combined, hey, Tom Daschle stinks, crazy bad liberal, and hey, give us money. A lot of what the Democrats did was, this time around, the Obama campaign just ran, hey, click here and donate tiny bits of money, and they had tons of people doing that. That allowed them to raise extraordinary sums of money. The rest of the space itself was strictly used as a communications forum. people friending each other on Facebook, and by doing so, being able to stay in touch with one another and let each other know what everyone was up to, what the new issues were, what the new lies were, what the new talking points were, whatever it happened to be that people needed to communicate to a group of like-minded individuals, they used the web to seriously positive effect in doing that. What I can say about using the internet for a messaging forum for politics is I think we're still not ready for it in terms of me buying ads on like allrecipes.com to talk to the female voter. That is just simply not an environment that people are comfortable with being spoken to about something that they deem that personal. And I've found that political messaging tends to be of the shouting and yelling variety, and that works great in a TV set that's on in the other room and you're doing dishes, but it's terrible in the lean-forward, personal, and more quiet environment of the web. I don't think that it's ready for that sort of thing. Right now, it's still going to be the bloggers and the, you know, Politico.com and the Daily Cause and the Drudge Report, whatever those different things are that want to try to carry political content.
Okay, that was helpful for me. I liked your perspective on it. And I want to ask you one more question before we go to the break. And this is just a quickie, but very interesting for our listeners. You and I were recently at the Aspen Group, part of iMedia, the iMedia Agency Summit, where it's a closed meeting just for the agency executive leadership. And John Durham, interestingly enough, from Catalyst San Francisco, ran a day called Agency RX. You broke up into work groups to come up with solving some of the bigger issues that agencies, digital agencies face today. Could you just tell us what those top issues were that you voted on to get together into breakout groups and discuss?
All right. What John had done when deciding what we should discuss during the Agency RX, and for anyone who's going, what's RX? I mean, it's a prescription for the agency of the future. And what are the most important things that need to be focused on? He had sent out a survey to 150 of the agency attendees, 96 of whom had responded, which is a pretty good response rate. And the five issues that had risen to the top as being the most important to agency executives and marketing leadership in the online space were the following. They were client value, the training and development of talent, reporting or metrics issues, emerging media, and finally collaboration.
And what did collaboration mean?
Collaboration means ultimately, what it really means is internal collaboration, though nobody said that. Well, they did. They focused on it a little bit. But they also tried to include the client. And the truth of the matter is that in order to have successful collaboration within your organization as an agency, you need to have it from your client as well. Client needs to communicate clearly to you what it is that they're looking for, so that way you can manifest that yourselves internally with the right people. And if those people are not somebody who sits with you or in your office or next to you or in your department, and you have to reach outside of that to get them, you need to do that. And that definitely comes from the client. But that's what that was.
That's good. That was very interesting. I'm sure it'll be interesting to anyone else who either is working with an agency or in an agency to find out what the key issues are for agencies going forward. So I want to take a break, thank our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Jim Miskauskas, the VP and online media director for Icon International. I want to talk about a story you recently did about whether the death of ad networks was greatly exaggerated.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to talk about that Don Epperson keynote, the CEO of Havas Digital, and what he was talking about changing the way we execute media, because that's interesting too. So, and then of course some fun things like peeing in Star Wars. So, and the Inca Trail. We've got a lot of work to cover, Jimmy. So let's go. Thank
okay.
my sponsors for allowing me to have this much fun with you. And when we come back, we'll get to our work.
Listen to Coaching the Life Coach, business and marketing strategies for growth of transformational practices, your guide in the 21st century marketplace on personallifemedia.com.
All right, we're back. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. We're with Jim Miskauskas, and let's get right to this death of the ad networks. Is it greatly exaggerated, or are there just too many? What do you think?
It is greatly exaggerated, and that there are too many.
I think that's technically cheating, Jim.
it might be, but I've always been one of those people who believes that if you're going to have cake, you might as well eat it, too. Yeah, there are too many, and the death of the ad network at large is not what we're it's not really what we're going to see. What we're going to see is the kind of consolidation that happens in any maturing marketplace.
Okay,
that is what we're going to get. I mean, what we've got now are literally hundreds of enterprises out there who are all basically fishing out the same hole. Now, the way I've tried to describe this to clients in the past who are looking for the right ad network, trying to see how they can maximize efficiency, which of course to them means cheap, but I always have to remind them that what efficiency is performance and cost and where those two things intersect. You know, if I've got 300 people holding a fishing pole and they're all dropping in the same line trying to fish out that hole, and what they're fishing here in this case is inventory that's cast far and wide, you know, whoever has the biggest worm is going to get the most bites. Now, that means that whoever's got that biggest worm is, you know, offering the marketplace larger monies. That's not going to be positive for everyone because everyone can't do that. And those that are going to be able to offer the kinds of costs to clients who think that efficiency is strictly just price, they're going to end up with only kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, crappy inventory. Now, I'm one of those people who firmly believes that if somebody is there at a site, whether I've heard of it or not, doesn't really matter. If that content place is important to someone, then the impression generated there is just as much value as one generated somewhere else where a client has heard of it. But what's going to happen is there's just not going to be enough left. And so all of these people who are going to offer the lowest rates out there are going to not be able to deliver. They're going to miss the market. They're not going to be able to bid out on the inventory. They're not going to deliver. And then the client, the agency, whomever it is that's buying their inventory or attempting to buy their inventory won't come back and they'll go out of business. The larger players are going to start probably, if they can, they have the capital reserves to do so, maybe merge with some of the medium-sized players. And the only reason they would do that is if those medium-sized players have relationships with publishers that these larger guys haven't been able to get, or they have some sort of technology or service that this other player is providing better than the gobblee, or the gobbler in this instance. And so I think the marketplace is actually strong for ad networks. I just don't know that I need 300 of them, and every time a truck rumbles by, another ad network is born. I don't think that's sustainable.
Is there any one definitive place you can go to find all the ad networks in the universe?
There is one place that is trying to position itself as the definitive place where you can go to buy all the other ad networks.
Oh, what's that?
That's Real Media 24/7's B3 networks.
Okay.
And they are kind of, it's interesting, they've been sort of under the radar, even though they've been operational for, gosh, I want to say, you know, a good 6 months to maybe even 3 quarters now, for the bulk of 2008. And you don't hear a lot about them. And a lot of it is because they are kind of, they're going to clients direct, they're going to the agencies direct, and they're not making a lot of noise in the marketplace on their own behalf. And what they propose, what they advocate they're able to do, is basically they go out and buy ad network inventory on ad networks. And what they will guarantee to you, the advertiser, is top of fold placement or above the fold placement. And the places that they put you, based on their metrics, their ability to optimize those placements, will yield greater, what they would say, are engagement values than if you just bought the ad network alone.
Okay, we're going to check out B3. That was helpful, and I wish I had time to talk to you about engagement versus impression versus click-through, because you've been railing on that subject for almost a dozen years.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's been a long time.
I want to make sure, and maybe we just have to have you come back, but I want to make sure I talk about Don Epperson's keynote at the iMedia Agency Summit, because what he was saying is that we have to entirely change the way agencies are executing their media buys and focus on buying around optimization and leveraging algorithms and managing databases, and that the agency needs to essentially get into the metrics business and buy the way publishers are selling. What? Tell me, how did that? Did I get it right? And how did that go over?
Yeah, you did. You did get it right, and it went over. I don't know. It's to say like a lead balloon, a mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, you were there.
Like, whoa, that's not how we like to operate. That's not our MO, right?
Well, the agencies were not as morose about his postulation as the publishing community was, because what he'd suggested, without actually saying it, though, when Doug Weaver asked him later, point blank about it, he did basically say yes, was that he would eventually be able to buy around publishers and essentially around ad networks and act as their own ad network and start to buy inventory from publishers or other locations where the audiences they are looking for can be found at lower costs, but married to more robust data that would allow them to extract greater value from the impressions that they were buying from these other places. Now, publishers didn't really like that idea because essentially what he suggested was that, you know, after I do business with you, NewYorkTimes.com or iVillage.com or whoever, I'm just making these up, for 30 days and I've collected the data I need, I now can find your audience somewhere else, and I've segmented them in such a way that I know how to maximize the value I'm going to extract from the impressions that I'm going to pay less for elsewhere, well, then I'm not going to buy you anymore.
It's retargeting, right?
More or less,
yeah.
Right. I mean, there are people in the behavioral marketing and the data economy space who probably would say no, it's a little more precise and nuanced than that. But yeah, essentially, that's what it is.
Interesting. So the publishers, the agencies then just skim off the information, grab that information into their own databases and don't need you anymore. Now they can essentially look at the entire industry as just one big potential network, right?
That is exactly what he was getting at.
Yeah.
Though he wouldn't say that was the vision. That was the vision. I mean, he still said, no, there's a good role out there for, you know, I think it was Scott McLernan, actually, who had asked, well, is there room for the consultative salesman anymore?
Right.
And he said, yes, sure, there is. But I think if pressed, he wouldn't have come up with any examples for it, given his vision of the future.
Yeah. Pretty cut and dried, data oriented. Very interesting.
Yeah, very data driven.
And what I like is at least a perspective on how it could be. You know, that will never be a perfect moment in time. But I think agencies are all moving that way of collecting their own data, like the purchase of 24/7, right?
That's correct. WPP's purchased 24/7. I mean, Havas is creating their own network. Everybody's trying to kind of figure that out and get into that space. And part of it is because there is a bulk of inventory out there whose value is not certain and whose price remains undetermined.
Yeah.
And so if what I can do is assign a cost to something and assign a value to it and figure out where those two things meet, and I can do it without having to deal with somebody else, I'm going to yield somewhat greater efficiencies on the part of my client. And, of course, the reason I'm doing that is because of a large ad agency, I'm getting paid almost nothing by these clients to do all this work.
Right.
So I got to find another way to make a little money.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to take a little switch now, and I want to just talk about some of the things that you like to do besides cleverly buy media. I did want to mention, too, that you write a column for iMedia. What's your official title there? It's Media Strategies Editor, is that right?
That is correct. It's Media Strategies Editor, and in fact, I actually address in this past Tuesday's column, and where they place it all the time, it depends on what it's about, and so sometimes I don't really know, but somewhere on the iMedia site, as of Tuesday of this week, there was a piece I did actually about the data issue that Epperson had raised.
Yeah, so if you want to read more about it, that's a good place to go.
I called it Data Everywhere. Can someone help me think? But I'm not sure if that's the headline I ran or not.
I don't think it is. Because I read that story and I don't remember that as the headline.
They probably changed
it.
Yeah, I'm sure they changed it. They probably ran out of room.
So you like 80s punk rock.
I do.
What kind of 80s punk rock? Because that's a pretty wide genre.
It is a very wide genre, and I am since I'm a California boy,
Berkeley.
It is mostly California stuff. And so the first punk rock I ever listened to, you know, I was probably junior high, and it was the Dead Kennedys.
Uh-huh.
Because they're a San Francisco band.
Sure.
And a guy I used to ride on the bus with, he's a couple years older, and he was a big fan. And of course, when you're like 11 or 12, older kids, you just want to do whatever they do.
Oh, and plus you want to be massively anarchic. Anarchistic.
That is correct.
You're just like one massive contrarian when you're 11 or 12 anyway, right?
Right. At 12 years old, you have no idea what the consequences of no rules might actually be.
Right.
But everybody's got the positive stuff. The early parts of Lord of the Flies seems appealing. You don't realize until you get to the end of the book how bad it can all go.
Exactly.
But Jello Biafra, you're just like, whoo!
Jello Biafra ran for what?
He ran for mayor.
Mayor of San Francisco or Berkeley?
That is correct.
Yeah.
San Francisco.
Right. And what else did you like? What other 80s punk rock did you like?
Black Flag.
Oh, I liked Henry Black
Rollins
Flag.
Old Dad.
Yeah, I liked them too. I liked X.
Oh, X was great when Christine changed her name to Xena.
Xene.
Xvina Cervinka. I liked X too. And again, there's another LA band.
What a classic. I loved Soul Kitchen.
Yep, and I used to listen to, what's funny is I listened to a lot of that, but I mean, my college years were late 80s, early 90s, and a lot of road trips spent with those bands on the tape deck,
yeah,
which is what people used to use in those days.
And have you been collecting Star Wars merchandise since you were a kid? Because
yes,
you're of the era that Star Wars came out when you were probably 11 or something, right?
Star Wars came out, I was 7 years old,
yeah, there you go,
almost eight, when the first movie came out. And my mom, on Mother's Day in 1978, bought me two Star Wars figures.
Which ones?
One was a Stormtrooper and one was Darth Vader.
Yeah.
And it's pretty funny because Darth Vader, of course, remained ever since my favorite character in the story. And I collected all the comic books and I've seen all the movies. Right now on my desk, I'm looking at Lego Star Wars pens that are, I think it's, we've got R2-D2, we've got Chewbacca, we've got Darth Vader, and you can actually take them apart and put them back together again. They're Legos, but they're also working writing pens. And I have a very large talking Darth Vader bank. When you put money in it, he speaks a little dialogue from the movies. Yeah, I collect all of it.
Do you actively collect it? Like, do you comb eBay and have alerts set up and stuff like that? Or does it just come into your life because you're open to it?
I did for a while, and then I met the woman who was to become my wife. And lo and behold, she did not want to be married to the 40-year-old virgin.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
right,
much like Catherine Keener's character,
yeah,
she's like, you know, you got to get rid of this stuff. And so I have not gotten rid of much of it yet,
yeah,
but my thousands of comics and my Star Wars merchandise and what have you, over the next, I don't know how long it will take, 10 years, I'll probably have to parse it out as Christmas presents to nephews or sell on eBay.
You're reminding me of Brad Behrens, who was also on the show. And of course, he had a garage full of comic books.
Yes, and he's a much bigger collector than
I
am.
And Shakespeare memorabilia. And
yes,
it had to go too.
Yep, I've had to move a lot of stuff to the office because one of the things, I don't know if they're still in these offices, but he used to have Shakespeare action figures.
He did?
Desk. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, very obscure toy maker makes them. They also make the Marie Antoinette action figure with a detachable head and you know, things like that, the Einstein action figure or the Sigmund Freud action
figure.
Oh,
yeah, those are cute.
They make those kinds of things.
Well, now you're going to read philosophers or listen to philosophers' notes, and
right,
you're going to have to get a bunch of new philosopher action figures. It's going to be your new thing.
I'm totally stoked. I can't wait to get the Nietzsche.
So, let's see. The axiom by which you live your life, you gave me a very strange answer. You said...
Yes.
Peeing.
Well, I said never pass up the opportunity to use the bathroom. I was trying to make it, you know, more all-inclusive.
I just brought it down to, you know.
But that is really the one.
Oh, so peeing and pooping. Peeing and pooping is the
action. That's right, but no, peeing is definitely it. That's the key. That's the very key function.
And why is this the axiom? Never miss an opportunity to go to the bathroom. Why is this the axiom for
Because
your life?
It's representative of human beings, and particularly Western human beings, and particularly North American Western human beings, and particularly those north of, say, Mexico. But the over-civilized world has a propensity to deny itself the things it really must do.
Mm.
And
right, we try to control everything.
Correct.
Not anything but control freak.
That's right, we do. And I grew up... doing a lot of road trips. My father didn't believe in flying. He thought that if you were a kid, you were too young to appreciate traveling in an airplane. And so you drove everywhere. And if you had to go to the bathroom, it was too damn bad. If you're making good time, you're going to keep going, and that's just how it is. And, you know, I mean, 5 hours until finally you're suffering classic kidney blowout is a little tough.
So you had some childhood issues around peeing, which is why this became your axiom. You've got like a little, was there bedwetting?
No, never.
Listen to how fast you came back with that.
Yep.
That tells me
there
was absolutely bedwetting.
Never, never. I never bedwetting. But yeah, I just feel like we deny ourselves a lot of what nature tells us to do.
Yeah.
And what our spirits tell us to do, and the things that don't have to do with economies or making money or any of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We have a tendency to try to control them all, and we have a very man versus nature mentality.
Yes.
When man is part of nature.
Yeah.
So anyway.
You know what I just did? I put a little trampoline, a rebounder, next to my desk. And a couple times a day, if I'm smart, I get up after I pee because it's really hard to rebound when you have to pee. It's like pretty much impossible. But it makes you work really hard. I get up on that rebounder and I just jump up and down 20 times and then I go back and sit at my desk and do some more work. Cause I'm always tethered to the phone, tethered to email, tethered to the web. You know, it's really tough cause we're just in these. I always say I have a butt shaped like an Aeron chair, you know.
Right.
And so I love the rebounder, the little mini trampoline. It's supposed to compress your, use gravity to compress your cells. So it's supposed to work to regenerate you at a cellular level. I don't know if that's true, but it's really fun to jump up and down 20 times and take a break.
That's right. Whatever it does, moving seems to help.
Moving is good.
Moving is good.
Absolutely.
That is right.
I know I've been taking up yoga and of course I've been doing this meditation. We did this meditation stuff at iMedia. Right.
Yes, which I thought was great.
And now I'm doing the jumping up and down. I'm trying to like put in the little things that get me moving again because we're getting old. I mean, that was one of the things we talked about at iMedia. You know, we're in this kind of, Jack Meyer says we're in a 30-year cycle, right? And so if we're going to make it, if we're not going to just like crash along the side of the road physically, we have to take care of ourselves as we do all this because we're really chained to our desks.
Yes, you are 100% correct.
So last thing that I want to talk to you about is the one thing that pushed you the hardest in your whole life. It was the edge pusher for Jim Mascouskas. Tell us about your trip on the Inca Trail.
Yes.
Take us there.
The Inca Trail. I went to Peru because I had always wanted to go. And a lot of my friends went right after college. And what I, of course, did is I went to the deserts of El Paso and worked as an unskilled manual laborer in the refineries there. But my friends all did
not your like, not your best move.
It was extremely educational,
I'm
but
sure.
That's definitely a topic for another time.
Yeah.
But all my friends got to travel the world and do the kinds of things that you know, well-heeled white folks get to do when they graduate from college. I didn't, and so I'd always kind of had this bug about Peru. I also am a big fan of pre-Columbian history and civilizations and all those kinds of things, and you know. Things about America, north, south, I was really interested. So I went to Peru, and I hiked the Inca Trail. And it was actually on this Inca Trail where I had decided that I was going to address something earlier, was that I was going to decide to leave advertising and try this kind of new life. And it was one of the more difficult things I've ever done, the most difficult thing I've ever done physically, even though it was short, about 28 miles. The first 2 days of 3.5 days was all uphill. At one point, the highest point you're at, I think, is a little over 14,000 foot elevation. So the air is thin. It's snowing and raining at the same time. I'm sweating like Paul Prudhomme on a hit of ecstasy. I can barely breathe. You know, your head is just crushing every step you take. And there kind of came this strange moment of, it's hard to explain, a kind of nothingness that was everything. And I stood at the top of what's known as Dead Woman's Pass, and you can look out and you can see an awful lot of the a big, big swath of the Andes and small little figures that are people walking up the trail and clouds around and snow in the distance. And I just sort of had this moment where I was at that point far enough away and had been gone long enough from my point of origin to know or feel that I knew where it was I wanted to go next. And what it was that I had liked most about what it is I had already been or places I had already been. And I don't know, there was kind of like the past and the present, the future all sort of collided at one place. And it was tough. I got sick as a dog. You know, I smelled horrible. I smelled like a French cabbie getting a permanent in the septic tank of a slaughterhouse. I was beat up and awful and nasty. And it was wonderful. It was really something else.
It was a vision quest for you.
It really was. I didn't know that it was going to turn out to be that way, but it did.
Mm-hmm. And this is where we leave the show with some kind of an inspirational thought. What would you encourage other people to do, knowing what you know about this experience of your own?
You mean my experiences in general, just of life, or the Inca Trail in particular?
You can answer that any way you'd like to, Jim.
Okay. I would say that you should never do anything that your soul finds distasteful. And I know that that means, at least the word soul means different things to different people. But I think it's one of those things that even if we can't define it, we all know what it is. And I think that we also know when we find something distasteful. And I mean in what it is we're doing in our careers, how it is that we're treating the people in our lives, how it is the people in our lives are treating us. Don't do anything a second longer than the moment your soul discovers that whatever that is distasteful.
Nice. So I would like to take this moment to tell you that I really appreciate that you're in our industry. I like the way you look. I like the way you act. I like the way you think. You're a warm-hearted, approachable person who has a really fun perspective, fun, deep, interesting, and heartfelt perspective on life. And I wanted to tell you today that I love you.
Thank you very much, Susan. That's really sweet. You know, I was just thinking that it's been many, many years since I first met you, and I think you might have been at Home.
I was, At Home Network.
Broadband. And I remember Enliven was something
we acquired
discussed.
That. Yeah.
And I thought, wow, it's been a really long time.
It's been a dozen years. And you told me that one of the other things that is an axiom in your life is that you want to make sure you tell people that you love them.
That's
and
right.
I thought, oh, well, I'm going to turn your axiom around on you and tell you that I love you. You are so welcome. All right. Well, you have gotten to know a little bit about a very deep man, Jim Mascouskas, Icon International. Jim, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks a lot, Susan. I love you, too.
You didn't have to say it, but
I know you do.
And I really enjoyed this time, Jim. I've been looking forward to our conversation. I hope you'll come back again. I think we have 27 million other things we could have great conversations about. And I know that people on the listening to the show today learned a lot of different things. You gave a lot to think about, which was really, really great. I thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime.
All right. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. I don't have a book to give away today, but I've always got some swag going on. If you want something and you listen to the show, don't forget to join the Dishy Mix Fan Club. Just go to dishymixfan.com, become a fan of the show, and I always have good stuff for you. So take care. Have a great day. I'm your host, Susan Bratton. I'll see you next week.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.